love food, and our new played cello, and his sisters Grace and Vivian played, one played piano, one played violin. So the Mingus Trio was a talk of the area at the time, because all we knew was the jazz we heard, Ellington, and maybe people like, Basie a little later, but we heard a lot of jazz, Benny Goodman, a lot of bands. But maybe the greatest thing was the Mingus Trio was a classical trio. I wondered, what could this guy be, would he be like 12 years old playing classical music, and bow-legged and heavy, so I looked for him. And this one day I spotted him, I said, "You got to be Mingus." And he was so shocked that I could know him. I said, "Well, I've heard about you." And he said, "You would have your hair cut differently." And he did, So also he had a shine box, was this high. And I used to shine shoes. My box was down where you could put your foot on top of it. And I said, "Well, why is your box so high?" He said, "Well, he likes to have his clients or people sit on it." There was, at that time, there was fenders on the cars, big fenders. So they would sit up on the fender high. And he had planned this out that would work for them. It was a pretty good idea if you had a big car, with a fender and everything. But anyway, I was kind of smiling. I said, "Well, you're Mingus, but if you have a bass, I would hire you with my band." I had a band at 12, but only because my parents actually, helped me to get the band. They used to have little parties on the weekends. And we didn't play that well, but they thought we played pretty good. So they would hire us, But the main thing I found at that period, if you have an audience, you'll play better. So what happened is that I said, if you get a bass, have your dad, trade the cello in and get a bass, you got a job. I didn't know whether he could play or not, but if he studied classical, he was on the trio, I think he must be all right. So I never heard him play any jazz, but that was my thing at the time. So what happened is, about a week later, I ran into him, and he said, "My dad got the bass. We traded the cello in the music store." So I got him on the job. About a week later, we didn't know any tunes, we didn't practice anything. But I just had confidence, he had so much music in him at the time. So anyway, we went on our first little gig, and I think at that age, I might even have had a car, at that time. I was maybe about 13 then, but my grandmother, she bought a new car. It was an old Dodge. And so the thing was that we went on our first job, and he didn't play all the right notes, but he had such a beat, a rhythm, so he had a musical background, and that worked. But anyway, we went through life, and we stayed together until he passed away in the 70s. The exciting times that we had, played the Monterey Festival with him, went to New York for the town hall, all these concerts, they would take an hour or so to tell about each incident, because he was that kind of person. There was never a dull moment with Mingus. He didn't want to do the town concert with a guy named George Ween, who was probably still around, who did a lot of, the Hollywood, the Vogue, and Newport, so many places that we didn't think of. But anyway, Mingus would get into beef with anybody, When I was there, he felt a little better, because I could keep him cool. Because he always went back to when we were 12 years old. When we were 12, we used to get on the red car from Watts, of course, and ride from one local, which stopped about every couple of miles, and had a bouncy feeling to it. And he would get a pepper bun on the face, he'd think it zip the cover off the bass, he said, "Let's jam." And I said, "Well, I don't know if they'll like let us play," because I didn't know that people would accept it at the time. And he'd start doom, 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 and start playing the bass thing. So I'd get the alto out and we'd play, and we'd jam, and the people loved it. So that was a big thing we learned, performing like that. You must be performing part of the time. All the practice in the room won't do it. But anyway, we'd do that every day, coming and going from Watts to up downtown, and then we'd be making rehearsal there when we'd get up there. But he loved to play like that, and he just got better each time. He was playing tunes or whatever we heard on the radio, we tried to play. But that happened until we grew up, and he always wanted me to be in concerts, Monterey, and places like that. But each time I would go, he would always be mad with somebody. George Ween said he didn't want a concert. He wanted, George Ween wanted a concert. The Mingus didn't want a concert. He wanted an open recording session. So an open recording session meant to him that he could stop and play, just like having you as an audience, he could do a tune. If he didn't like it, he'd stop right in the middle of it. And then a couple of tunes he played, and he went to the mic like I'm here, and he said, I wouldn't buy that, would you? And George has pulled a chair out in the wings. He went to concert, and Mingus is stopping. And the music was so good, and the band was so good, he must have about 35 of one of the best musicians in New York. And he's stopping right in the middle. When it really goes, then he can stop and say, and so that wasn't a good lead. I wouldn't buy that one. He said, we'll try another one. And that went on all the time until the audience actually was very upset. And he had an uncle at that time that got on the stand and played some Dixieland, and they broke it up. They were A1, and we hadn't done anything. So after the intermission, the concert resumed, and we went back on the stand. And I just felt so terrible. I had flown into New York, and I was so unhappy. I'd given up a good job here. It's nothing to do with that. But after the intermission, he did the same thing. And we were all dressed in tux. He was sharp, you know, the cummerbund and all the thing, and the ties and everything. And he came on with sandals and blue jeans and a leather jacket and a wash and wear shirt type thing. And he was just happy. And it was just weird chaos. But anyway, the final thing was we got on and did the same thing. And the stagehands began to pull the curtains, you know, because 11 o'clock, you know, the time there gets in the overtime, maybe 11:30. So they began to pull the curtains, and the audience ran and pulled the curtains from the floor, you know. And they pulled them back, and they tried to close them, and the audience was opening, said, like, they haven't had enough yet for their money. But anyway, I give Clark Terry, I know you all know that name, Clark was in the band, Ernie Royal, all the top, Bernie Glow, all those names. I just got, he had about six bass players, Milt Hinton, George DeVivier, you know, it was top rate, Jerome Richardson, Phil Woods, Danny Banks, all the guys, ladies were there. But anyway, the final thing of this is that we were just dying, and they were trying to close the curtain, and I just said, what a terrible thing for me to come to New York and, you know, not even sure what I could do. Not that I was playing that much, they had so many good players. Eric Dolphy was there too at the time. But the final thing was that we didn't know what to do. We all were just kind of dumbfounded with the tug of war going on with the curtain. And but after this, Clark was there, you know, and he'd been with Ellington that time, I mean, before that. And so he went into a mellotone, ba-da-da-da-da. And then the band was so hungry to play, the band just started jamming on that tune, and that was the best thing in that long night. And the audience allowed us to, you know, to go on and continue. And then the stagehand stopped pulling the curtain, because now it was just, you know, it was finally music that we had all been waiting for all night, and we ended on that jam tune. And they did put the record out, they recorded that evening, but the only really thing on that complete thing is the mellow tone. After it was supposed to be a big concert, it was a jam thing. But Mingus, there were always surprises, and I could collect the stories, a million stories, so I won't stay with that very much. But the other thing I want to say, because Michelle wanted me to say something about the days of the 40s here, when we got the two unions together. There was the black and white union. I don't know, a lot of you knew that, but for a long time, a lot of people didn't know that. And I came back to the service in 1945 or so, and Mingus again was there. We had a group called the Stars of Swing at the Downbeat on Central Avenue. And he and I used to go every night, and we could play and say, well, the only thing about this is that I went into the service. He didn't go to the service because he said he had bad feet. He said a lot of things, you know, we got him out. We got to 4F or whatever it was, and he stayed out. But then we put his car, and I said, why can't we do something about the unions? He said, well, let's work together. We can do it. And he got the first job. It was like the first test case. Would you want to say something? Oh, I'm sorry. No, you were waiting. Okay, the test case was that there was a job at the Million Dollar Theater, which is on 3rd and Broadway, and the star at this time, the artist, was Billy Eckstein, who had a band, but this time he didn't bring his band. He came alone, and we were talking about getting the one union out of the two so blacks and whites could work together, and this job was a... you know, about 18, 19 pieces, and the leader was a guy named Tommy Peterson, who played like Tommy Dorsey, trombone leader. And Mingus was the only non-white hired, and he was always very light-skinned, so a lot of people didn't know he was Latin or black. So either way, he was so unhappy with that because he wanted me to be with him. But anyway, he told the guys every day is a show, you know, maybe 5 days, 6 days a week, maybe 7 days a week on Saturday and maybe Sunday, matinees. And so he would tell the guys that you must be prejudiced because, you know, you should have others in here that other than myself. And he says, you have Buddy Collette here. And they didn't even know me. So he would tell my name, you know, each day he would tell them that he could read all of your music. He would always push me. I think mainly he did that because I helped him, you know, get to the bass, and he loved the bass and he played it very well, as you know. But anyway, that's where we started. So he's made so much noise about we wanted one union. The guy said, well, can you bring him down so he can talk to us? We don't know what you're talking about. He said, well, he wants one union because he knows that'll work. So I went to the theater on an off day, and we sat in the back room. There's a flute player there, a good flute player. And he said, no, I think he can play better than you. He's been playing 2 years. I said, you're getting me into trouble. I don't want to, you know, try to match a guy that can match the flute. I was just starting on the flute. I played saxophone, you know, but anyway, we get there, and we have like a little showcase in the back room of the theater. And a lot of the musicians stayed there to meet me because he had told so much about me. He said he just wants one union. So one gentleman named Milt Holland was a symphony player from Chicago. And he said, well, what do you want? You want to have a meeting or something? I said, no, our guys don't want to have a meeting. They want to get some work. And they want to also learn how to play the classical music. I said, why don't we suggest a symphony orchestra, like a interracial, first interracial symphony orchestra. So the one guy said, okay, you get as many guys as you can get, meaning the non-white guys, and I got about 10 or 15 people, like Red Callender, who was one of the great bass players and teacher for a lot of wonderful teacher, you know, people, bass players. He even taught Mingus a lot. And so what would finally happen is that we had this rehearsal, the symphony, I was the first symphony rehearsal at a hall called Normandy Hall at Jefferson in Normandy. Yeah, I think that was at Jefferson in Normandy. And they had the press there, like Times and everybody, you know, but it wasn't a big thing that they wrote about because nobody knew what it was about. And some people didn't know there was, you know, the two unions. But anyway, we started it, and the bass player at the time was a young man named Henry Lewis, a young black man who knew the classical work, and he was finally married to Marilyn Horn, and he did a lot in the classical world, so some of you probably know that name. But anyway, that was the beginning of that. We also have jam sessions on Sundays, so we invited the classical people to come to jam sessions. So this whole idea was just so people would get to know each other and also know the music that they weren't familiar with. And I learned about people like Jimmy Cheatham, who passed away about a year ago or something. He was in the band, Red Callender, Bill Green, wonderful Bill Green, you all know that name. They were all there because we were the top players that could play the music. So we began to join together. And every week was kind of fun, you know, getting to know people and know music. And one of the great conductors, Isaac Solomon, was in town. And they said, guys like, I'm trying to think of the truth, Joe Ager was a French harp player. He said, how would you like to conduct the first interracial symphony orchestra? He said, I'd love to do that. So he came and, you know, brought a lot of prestige and everything to that. So we just kept working like that. And finally, I'll move on a little later, but we found out the Academy Awards had never had a, you know, interracial band or anything like that. And the only blacks that had been on the stage had been Louis Armstrong. And Louis Armstrong could go anywhere, of course, you know. But anyway, this night we decided that if they didn't hire some black musicians in the Academy Awards orchestra, that there was going to be a picket line. That was in 1964. And that was a year before the Watts riot, so the area was getting pretty heated, as you know. But anyway, we got three people in that band on the Academy Awards in 1964. Bill Green, and I was one there, a lady named Tony Robinson, who played harp. So it was a very exciting evening. The only problem, but like you there with the audience, they had me right here in the first chair toward the audience, and the camera was right there, and the camera was supposed to dolly in on me and then go up on stage. So they could, you know, make people around the world be happy that the band had finally integrated it. But anyway, there was one period I got a push on my back, and I was held. I looked at the trauma face, what are you doing? You mad at me? And he said, no, they almost knocked your head off with that. They knew where the guy had his feet on, you know. They were so busy trying to dolly into the stage. But those were the days that, like I say, you know, much different than now. We finally achieved that. At the end, I'll end this story, but they finally didn't change it. After 3 years, they had the same three black people in the orchestra, you know, African-Americans. And I said, well, is this going to ever change? Because we didn't ever work anywhere other than there at the time. I mean, we worked other places, but not with this same group, the same leader, John Green and all of them. But finally, there was a thing where about the fourth year, I said, I don't want to do it again. I've always been kind of guy that only do so much, you know, and say, no, I can't handle that if that's what they're gonna do. I'd rather go somewhere else. So we got to the paper and it got to the contract. It was Bobby Hill. And then, you know, time to the party, he said, buddy, why didn't you take this job? And I said, only because they've hired the same three people each time and they don't hire someplace else. So they couldn't figure that was money. It's the best show in town. I said, well, that's true, but they're still not being fair with us. So the final thing I said, well, I didn't just feel like I could play as well when I'm there, and I'm knowing that, you know, they're kind of using me just to show the people that they've hired a few blacks, and we're the only ones that can play that. And I said, a lot of people can play that if they studied and worked hard. So the final thing of that was that, then he asked Ray Brown, who was hired that year, who was wonderful bassist, you know, and so he said, Ray, you took the job? And he said, yeah, he said, I was happy to take the job. And so the contractor said, well, they said, maybe Buddy was wrong. He said, they would have been four if he had, you know, in other words, I was going to have four that year. If, you know, if Buddy had stayed in there, then Ray Brown would be four with Bill. But he actually fired Ray because I wasn't there. He kept the number three, if you follow what I'm saying. It was still three. When I quit, he hired Ray. He didn't have Ray when we were there. So my point was they'll never hire more than three. Because then when I first started with Groucho, there was only one in there. And I was kind of lonely in a way. The guy said, well, don't you feel lonely? I said, no, I grew up this way with everybody. But the point was, you know, there were times they'd be talking about stuff that I'm not talking about only because I was in the jazz world also at that time. But it was a wonderful experience, but we made a lot of friends and we found a lot of people who were happy with what we did, and it finally paid off. Or we found people like Class Johnson and you know, a whole lot of people that could play that came into town, and they did very well and helped change the music on, well, not so much now, but through that period, a lot of jazz bands played at NBC, the Tonight Show, and a lot of those things. We kind of integrated all that stuff. So that was a very happy period for me to be involved in it, and so many wonderful people, black and white players, that work together now, and they got, you know, a lot going for all of them. So I just want to say that we all have a lot of work to do to speak out when things are not right and follow your dreams and follow your wishes and things that you feel can make things better. And I want to go to the band you're going to hear next. It's a gentleman I've known for most of them, for at least 20 years or more. And you got Mr. Richard Simon, who was my bass player in my band when we were playing. When we still play, he's the worst one. You got Mr. Dave Coons, also, who's a gentleman that worked with me a lot. They're the finest players in town. And we got Mr. John Stevens, who helps me get around town. He also plays his instruments right. He's got his own band. And we got a guest artist, a guy named Russ Mullin. So these are people I've known for at least 20 years, or more, 10, 15, 20 years. And you will hear them, and they might talk again. But they're wonderful musicians, and part of what I'm doing now is because I learned so much from them and being around them. You know, they're wonderful human beings, and they know what I'm talking about as far as working together and make music better and just keep jazz alive. And we have a group, a young group called Jazz America, that Richard's keeping together. I started with a couple other people, but now when I had the stroke, Richard just took over. He didn't do much. He came in with my daughter and got the stuff that we had and went on with it. So he deserves a lot of credit. He might tell you something about that. But the kids are learning. They're playing real music, not the, you know, so-called music of today that doesn't take much study. But they really have the roots. And some of them going to college, and it's just so wonderful having them keep doing that. And so I had to bring them with me today. And I know I probably ran out of time here, but some of these stories just go on and on. But, you know, they're wonderful. I've lived them, and I relive them when I tell them. So let's say, let's hear some music. So thank you.